hear Luther hammering on the church door there? That means phone lines are open right now. You can call in and register for our Lutheran Study Bible, the brand new Lutheran Study Bible. The numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. We're going to give away four Lutheran Study Bibles on Friday, October 30th. And then we're going to give away three grand prizes of the Lutheran Study Bible paired up with the Treasure of Daily Prayer. So you probably want to get your name and telephone number in the hopper, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We say good morning and welcome to Dr. Martin Noland. He is pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. It's been pretty exciting here as the registrations come in for our Bible giveaway, Pastor. We get a lot from Indiana. You've got a good state over there, I think.
Well, we sure do. We have a lot of Lutherans over here, you know.
Yes, we do. And you are now in Evansville. People will remember your voice from the days when you were at the Concordia Historical Institute here in St. Louis on the campus of Concordia Seminary, and now back into the pastoral ministry. How long have you been at Trinity?
2 months now.
2 months. Have you hit your rhythm, Pastor? Or has it all come back to you? Is it like riding a bicycle?
or like playing tennis when you haven't played for 20 years.
Yeah.
Some things just come back right away, and other things take a while. And the things with pastors, when they move from one parish to the next, each parish has different challenges and responsibilities. So sometimes you have to develop skills that you never had before. Yeah, there's a little bit of that. The basics, I'm back into stride and we're moving along.
Well, with your permission, I guess we'll go to work here. Our numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. If you want to use those numbers to register for our Lutheran Study Bible giveaway, you can do that. Just tell Sally, or if you want to come on the air, same numbers will work. Let's take this phone call. Hi, Bill, you're on the Bible study.
Yes, good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
The question I have for Dr. Noland is, I was just wondering, with all the archaeological digging in the Mideast and that, I was just wondering if there's any latest archaeological finds that helped support Christiana's beliefs. And I was just wondering if he personally thinks that, is there a possibility that sometimes when they find something that supports Jesus and what he's done for us, the Christian faith of the Christian Christianity, I can't express this, if some of it is kind of hidden, kind of not brought out, so because of the Jewish reaction, the Orthodox Jewish beliefs, and that they don't want the idea of Jesus being the Messiah, brought that out.
All right, we'll talk about it.
And I have one more question.
Okay, go ahead.
The question is, approximately when was the first bishop actually called the Pope, or he took the title of Pope? I was wondering about what date that would be, the century on that. And I'll hang up and listen to what you have to say. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Doctor?
Wow.
I don't know. How much do you know about archaeology?
Am I still here?
Yeah, you are.
Okay. I do know a little bit about the archaeology of the Bible, and that's something most of our pastors get a little bit in their coursework. The big journal that's popular in the United States is called Biblical Archaeology Review. And they just had a special issue. It's their 200th issue. It may still be in bookstores. And what they did was overview all of the important things that have happened in the last 200 issues, which I think has been since 1950 or something like that. I have not had a chance because I've been too busy learning my new stuff here. Well, here, let's go to top 10 discoveries. This would be their favorite finds. Ashkelon's arched gate in southern Israel. What they're doing is digging up stuff in the Middle East. Since the Israelis have been there, they have a vested interest in proving that the Jews were actually there. And so the archaeology that's happening in Palestine is proving that the Jews were there at the time that the Bible says. This is an issue because in the 19th century, many scholars thought that most of the Old Testament was mythological or legend, and that even David wasn't a real figure. And all this stuff that's been happening in the last 50 years or so is proving that the Bible is, historically, it's right on the mark. So I recommend the readers, they can go to the website, I think it's, let's see here, bib-arch.org, or pick up that magazine at your library, and you can see what's going on. It's really very fascinating. In terms of the most recent thing that's going on, you should talk to Dr. David Adams, and I don't know if he's made everything public yet, but when I talked to him about a year ago, so I guess it must be public by this point, he was on a dig, and a dig, by the way, is what they call whenever the archaeologists are digging into the ground. It's just short for that work they're doing. He was in a dig in Judea overlooking the plains of Philistia. And there was it used to be a castle there, and there's still some remains of that. And they were digging around, and they found some, in fact, I think he was in the team of like half dozen people that actually found this potsherd that had some names from the time of David. And it's very significant because then it proves that that level of that castle or those fortifications were there at the time of King David and Saul, and the business about Israel against Philistia is proved archaeologically that way. So that's the most recent thing I know about, and if you can get Dr. David Adams from the seminary on your show, he can give that to you in detail. Now, the last question, let's see, I missed that one.
The last question was, is there any reason to suspect that various religious authorities that may have control over these digs or the land where the digs are taking place might be in a position to suppress information or details that support the Christian faith, archaeology that supports the Christian faith, which would maybe go against whatever religious group happens to own the property? So do we worry that sometimes these facts might be suppressed?
It's a concern that historians always have. And archaeology is a branch of history. So historians over the years have tried to figure out the best ways to prevent fraud, because that would be fraud. If you find something and it's historical, and it needs to be known by the historical community, and you throw it away or do something to it to deface it, that is fraud. And there are, in many countries, if you do something like that to an historical object that you found, there are legal punishments for it. I don't know what the case is in Israel, but anyway, the historians over the years have tried to figure out ways so that this type of stuff doesn't go on. And one of the things, it's like in a financial, let's say a financial secretary at church, you don't have just one person receiving all the money and making all the deposits and making all the checks, because there's too big of a temptation for fraud. So it's what they call a financial control. You have somebody that's not related that works with you, and then there's also an audit. So there's several ways that you can prevent that sort of fraud. And the historians that are involved with any of the official digs, they all do that. I won't get into the technical details, but there's supervision. There are other parties. There's not just one religious sectarian that says, oh, it's mine, and I'm not going to let anybody else see it. And no, that doesn't happen. I mean, there are people that try to come in and do those things, and they're quickly shooed away. You have to get permits from the government, and then the government, because this is part of their heritage, they want to make sure that it's properly preserved and that sort of fraud doesn't happen.
All right, here's another question for you from the website My Way. The headline is, Congress acts to extend hate crimes to cover gays. From Washington, the House voted on Thursday to make it a federal crime to assault people because of their sexual orientation, significantly expanding the hate crimes law enacted in the days after Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination in 1968. With expected passage by the Senate, federal prosecutors will for the first time be able to intervene in cases of violence perpetrated against gays. Civil rights groups and their Democratic allies have been trying for more than a decade to broaden the reach of hate crimes law. This time it appears they will succeed. The measure is attached to a must-pass $680 billion defense policy bill, and President Barack Obama, unlike President George W. Bush, is a strong supporter. The House passed the defense bill 281-146 with 15 Democrats and 131 Republicans in opposition. GOP opponents were not assuaged by late changes in the bill to strengthen protections for religious speech and association. Critics argued that pastors expressing beliefs about homosexuality could be prosecuted if their sermons were connected to later acts of violence against gays. Supporters countered that prosecutions could occur only when bodily injury is involved, and no minister or protester could be targeted for expressing opposition to homosexuality. Are you comforted by that, Pastor, or are you concerned?
Well, I'm not too bothered by it, because if they are using the legal definition of assault, which is kind of hard to tell from the report that you have there, it's not your fault. The journalists don't always know about this stuff. Assault technically is when I will say to somebody in front of me, I'm going to hurt you. So it's a direct threat of bodily harm. And a lot of people know about the technical term assault and battery. So I will tell you, I'm going to hurt you, and then you hit them. Well, the hitting is battery. Assault is when you verbally or non-verbally indicate that you're going to do it. If a pastor in the pulpit is telling somebody in the congregation, I'm going to hurt you, he should be in the pulpit. What is he doing there? That is assault, and it is under various regions and states, it's a crime. And no pastor should be doing that. No pastor should be encouraging anybody to commit violence against anybody else. So whether it's direct assault or encourage, and I believe they call it enticement to assault, no pastor should do that. I know that there are some crazy ministers out there, and they're, who knows? I mean, they're these storefront churches, and they lay their hands on a guy, and suddenly he's their pastor, and he says all sorts of strange things. They say, go boy, let's do it, let's go do it. You know, and that type of thing we shouldn't tolerate in our society, I don't think. I'm not in favor of it. Martin Luther makes very clear, even in the issue of belief, that there's no way that somebody should be prosecuted or hurt in any way for their belief. You cannot force people to believe. This is part of his teaching, and it is not something that maybe in the Middle Ages the idea was, well, we'll torture somebody so that they will come around. Luther and the Reformers were against that, partly because they had received much of that. So if that's what this is talking about, I don't have any problem with it. I think it's good legislation. If it is intended to prevent ministers and churches from making a moral judgment about what is right and wrong, if that's the intent or the result, then the legislation is wrong. And I don't know enough about it to pass judgment on that.
Here's another story from the Associated Press, which is a little troubling. a fundamentalist couple in Pennsylvania who prayed over their sick toddler rather than get medical help before his pneumonia death, have been ordered to stand trial on manslaughter charges. Prosecutors believe 2-year-old Kent Scheibel died because his parents chose prayer over modern medicine. But defense lawyers deny the case hinges on religious freedom. They say Herbert and Catherine Scheibel did not know their son was dying. About a dozen U.S. children die each year in such cases, often from diabetes, pneumonia, and other treatable illnesses. That's according to Sean Francis Peters, a University of Wisconsin lecturer, who wrote, quote, "When prayer fails, that is faith healing, children and the law," unquote. Peters says the parents often claim they fail to recognize the severity of the illness. The Scheibels, who quit school after ninth grade, work as teachers at their church, First Century Gospel Church in Philadelphia. The Philadelphia judge, who upheld involuntary manslaughter, child endangerment, and conspiracy charges against the Scheibels, called them loving but misguided. Should these parents be tried for manslaughter, Pastor?
It's, again, a little bit difficult to judge this particular case, and that's why they have a trial to determine whether or not the parents intentionally let their child die in this way. The normal way, the right way, as Lutherans, we believe that God has given us various means. There's created means, and there is the redemption means. We have the means of grace, of word and sacraments that we use to sustain our soul, and we have the created means of medicine and doctors and all those things to help maintain our bodies. And Lutherans believe that that's the right thing to do. So as a Lutheran, I would tell my congregational member, you need to go take that boy to the doctor right now. However, there are other now we're getting into the area of religious freedom in our country. And there's two issues here. The first issue is to what extent do parents have authority over the children and their welfare? And that's a legal issue. Different countries have different rules on that. The Roman society at the time of Jesus had the view that the father was the absolute, no law could pass by the father's authority. And if the father decided that kid is impossible, I'm going to kill him, he had the right to do that. I don't think that was a just law myself, but there are societies where there is greater or less interference, you would say, from society into the family. So that's one issue, and it's not really a theological issue. It's more of it's a social legal issue. And the second issue is the business about prayer versus healing. And I believe it was Mary Baker Eddy, who founded the Church of Christ Scientist, what's known as Christian Science. And if I'm getting this wrong, you should let me know. It's another group. But I'm pretty sure that's the ones that believe that through prayer that people could be healed. And that if they didn't pray, well, then they got what they got. But that they should wait for God to heal them through prayer and not go to doctors. And this is actually part of my own family history, because I believe it was my paternal grandfather's sisters and maybe some other family members that had joined the Christian Science movement in the early 20th century, and some type of disease came through the town, and they refused to go to the doctors, and they died. And so that reduced the number of family members that my grandfather grew up with, because they had belonged to Christian Science. This is the issue for the United States is to what extent can we tolerate Christian Science. And I think that the law has said that it is a matter of their freedom of religion. And if you're a Christian Science practitioner, and a member of that church, then you have a right to, both for yourself and your family, to deny yourself medical care, because it is a religious issue, and that's protected under the First Amendment.
One more story here before we get to the bottom of the hour. Seems like we have no shortage of Associated Press religious stories today. You're familiar with Franklin Graham?
Yes.
Billy
Graham. Billy Graham, yeah.
Right. He's an evangelist, and he has temporarily given up future contributions to his retirement plans from the two ministries where he is the CEO. Graham says his total compensation, quote, looks terrible, unquote, and that people won't understand it. The Charlotte Observer reported yesterday that Graham receives two full-time salaries and two retirement packages, one each from the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association and Samaritan's Purse. His total compensation from the two last year was $1.2 million. That's the sum of $535,000 from Samaritan's Purse and $669,000 from the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. The newspaper reports that Graham asked the heads of the two ministries' compensation committees Tuesday to cut off contributions to his retirement plan for the time being. Most of Graham's compensation in 2008 came from accelerated contributions to his retirement. Graham received no retirement in his first five-plus years at Samaritan's Purse and first year at the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. In February, the Evangelistic Association laid off 55 people. Now, the worker is worth his wage, is he not, Pastor?
Yes.
Is he worth $1.2 million in wages?
Yeah, isn't that also an issue at in St. Louis with the Joyce Meyer Ministries? I remember when I was in St. Louis, that was in the papers about every other year.
Well, there was a senator, United States senator, who was looking into a number of evangelistic associations.
Right. And was that ever resolved? I don't remember.
As far as I know, it's ongoing. No, I have not. I'm not aware of a resolution, but it begs the same question. For many pastors, we know, and I know a lot of them, so I know this to be true, they are underpaid. And we think that is wrong. But can a pastor be overpaid if there is a compensation committee, and there are, and they have come to the conclusion that Franklin Graham should be compensated X number of dollars? Are we entitled to have an opinion about that? Are we obligated to ask those questions and have an opinion about it?
Yeah, I think we have a right to ask those things. Compensation of ministers is it covers the entire history of the Christian church. If you look at the epistles of Paul, there's a number of places where he talks about that. And generally the problem that he has there is that they weren't being supported. So he uses the analogy of the, you know, don't muzzle the ox, laborers worthy of his hire, those that preach and teach are worth the double honor. And that's usually the normal problem. In the case of Franklin Graham, he's not really a pastor.
All right, hold your thought right there. We're talking with Dr. Martin Nolan today here, and we're going to come back to this subject on the other side of our break. Phone numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. What do you think?
Your retirement plans are in place. Warm winters, travel, golf, finally lower stress. But millions of grandparents, instead of spending their retirement years as planned, are picking up the pieces for their grandchildren, serving in the role of grandparents as parents. Hi, I'm Phyllis Wallace. Hear from the experts and the grandparents themselves how to succeed in this daunting but doable task. Next time, Woman to Woman.
Saturday mornings at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
On the next Adventure in Odyssey, a warning.
We haven't much time. They're on their way.
Who is?
General Little's special guards. They've been instructed to arrest you.
On what charge?
Treason.
That's insane.
Insane or not, that's what my father wants.
Well, no one will believe it. How could they prove a charge of treason?
You underestimate my father.
What will happen next? Find out on the next Adventure in Odyssey.
Saturday mornings at 8:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Spiders that make their livings through thievery. That's next on today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moments host, Ian Taylor.
Out of the more than 30,000 species of spiders, there are three species that make their living through thievery. That number was recently raised from two with the discovery of a tiny thieving species on the island of Taiwan. The other two species live in South America and are known to steal only silk from the webs of the other spiders. This strange little spider from Taiwan steals much more than just silk and is described as looking like a tiny drop of mercury with legs attached. It preys on the webs of giant wood spiders, whose webs can be more than 3 feet across. Many spiders eat their own webs for the purpose of recycling the silk to repair a tattered web. But this newly discovered little thief eats the webs of the giant wood spider. Researchers say that these little spiders can, on the average, make a wood spider's web 21% smaller. They have also been seen stealing small insects from the wood spider's web, as well as the wood spider's eggs. They are able to do this because they are small and rather sneaky. They do spin their own webs when they are ready to lay eggs, and they also spin their own silk to cover their eggs. While it is wrong for us to steal, theft is apparently the way God has chosen to feed these spiders in a fallen world. That our world is corrupted by our own sin should remind us that God is our ultimate provider. He has even prepared forgiveness and eternal life for us through the holy life and innocent suffering and death of His own Son, Jesus Christ.
To get a complete set of transcripts from Creation Moments programs, ask about the book Letting God Create Your Day when you visit us online at creationmoments.com. And join us again for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
I'm Diane.
And I'm Roland.
On the next afternoon show, 3 to 6 on AM 850 KFUO.
Safely squirreled away in a bunker below a nondescript cornfield in Indiana, Pastor Fred Hoover joins us to talk about...
evil?
Is that wordplay?
That's wordplay. It's going to be a good one, too.
Okay. Join us 3 to 6 on Friday for the afternoon show on AM 850 KFUO.
Bring your mini-me. It'll be fun.
Nocturnal creatures like bats, possums, and owls do the same things daytime animals do. It just happens to be dark when they do it. It's the creatures of the night which makes Friday Night Live Nightlife Boogie a special event at Powder Valley Conservation Nature Center in Kirkwood. Missouri's Creatures of the Night will be introduced to you at Nightlife Boogie Friday, October 16th from 6 to 9. There's something for everyone in your family. Powder Valley Conservation Nature Reserve is near the corner of I-44 and I-270 at 11715 Cragwald Road.
This is our Ask the Pastor Bible study. Our guest today is Dr. Martin Noland. Dr. Noland is pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. Pastor there for about 8 weeks now. We're talking about this story in the news today coming out of Charlotte, North Carolina, where evangelist Franklin Graham has given up future contributions to his retirement plans. And this story says his total compensation, and apparently quotes him, using quotation marks, looks terrible. And further quotes him saying, people won't understand it. There is kind of an eyebrow-raising reality here, Pastor. Whether we want to make the distinction that Franklin Graham is not a pastor, as you are a pastor, basically he's doing church work, wouldn't you agree?
Well, I think that's one of the issues. You said it earlier that he's a CEO.
He's an evangelist. I mean, his title here in the story is Evangelist Franklin Graham.
That's what they say. Okay, I won't disagree with that. But he is the president and CEO of the Billy Graham Association. He is also the he's the president of the Samaritan's Purse. That's an executive position, and then you have to say, why would you put somebody into that position that is a preacher as opposed to somebody that's trained in not-for-profit administration? You really should have an executive that knows about not-for-profit administration, which is a complex topic. It's very legally, it's got a lot of financial stuff attached to it, What does a preacher know about that? What does an evangelist know about that? The reason that this happens, and I'm not picking on Franklin Graham. He's the guy that you brought up. The reason it happens is that he's a fundraiser, basically, and the board of directors of those two organizations, they say, who can we get to be the president that's going to raise the most amount of money for us? Well, we find somebody that's a celebrity, and then we'll have fundraising dinners, and he'll get to meet heads of states, and this will put us in the limelight, and we will make a lot of money that way. So really, that's really what he does. It's not just that he's preaching the Word of God. It's the fact that he's got his father's name. He's kind of fit into his, I think Joel Osteen did the same thing down in Houston, Texas. His father built up that ministry, and Joel's taken over it now. And people will pay to meet these guys because, I mean, well, I never met Billy Graham. Did you, Chuck?
No, I have not.
No, nobody's going to pay to see me, but I would go pay to see and talk and shake hands with Billy Graham. And so that's why these organizations will take somebody like this that either has a large following, somebody like Joyce Meyer, or that has a celebrity name like Graham.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that, putting a popular person, making that person the face of your organization.
Right.
That just makes sense to me.
Right. And so that really is not the issue, but you got to realize you're dealing with apples and oranges. I mean, the way that evangelists have developed in the United States, you have a few guys that now are celebrities. And it's what happened with the media, especially television, under the Billy Graham organization in the 1950s. They figured out how to use television effectively, and that just mushroomed. And so where there used to be a lot of evangelists among the evangelicals, and they would work the big cities, and then they started using radio, which is how KFUO got started with Walter A. Meyer. But then when TV came along, what it did was concentrate all the efforts and all the money into a few people. And you can see, if you go across your TV dial, you can see a couple of those. Some of them passed away recently, but Billy Graham's still with us, but he's not working like his son. And so these are very popular people, they're well known, and they can raise money, and this is why they rise to that position. Are they a pastor? No, they're not really a pastor. In fact, Billy Graham once said, and he was asked whether he was a pastor, and he said no. And he says, actually, I do work that is less important than what a pastor does.
Was he right?
But somebody needs to do it.
Was he right?
I think so, because the gospel needs to get out. It needs to be heard, and by the next generation as well. There are countries that are closed off, like Russia was for, 70 years, and then it opens up again. And so then all the evangelistic organizations start sending their missionaries, and Missouri Synod did too. There's a new generation of people there that never heard about Jesus at all. And so that type of work, however you do it, is very important. But there's also the grunt work, the day-to-day work of raising families, raising children in the faith, helping out folks that are moving along in their faith life and meeting challenges, and in the older years that they, still receive the sacrament of the Word. That's the work that the Lord has given us to do as pastors, and we need a lot more pastors than we need evangelists. We may need as many missionaries, but that's a different issue. When we're talking about an evangelist today, 21st century, we mean somebody like Franklin Graham that gets on TV and he's a big celebrity, and nobody else really qualifies for that except for him and a couple others.
All right, I want to turn my attention to Mark chapter 10 here. This is a text that some folks may be hearing in church this weekend. Verses 17 through 22. Now, I don't know about you, Pastor. I like a good story. And when I enjoy a good story, whether it's reading or watching a movie, whatever. Generally speaking, I'm pretty much interested in the happy outcome, the happy ending. Now, we have this story of the so-called rich young man in Mark chapter 10, where it reads, "As Jesus started on his way, a man ran up to him and fell on his knees before him. 'Good teacher,' he asked, 'what must I do to inherit eternal life?' 'Why do you call me good?' Jesus answered. 'No one is good except God alone. You know the commandments: do not murder, do not commit adultery, do not steal, do not give false testimony, do not defraud, honor your father and mother.' 'Teacher,' he declared, 'all these I have kept since I was a boy.' Jesus looked at him and loved him. 'One thing you lack,' he said. 'Go, sell everything you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me.' At this, the man's face fell. He went away sad because he had great wealth." Here endeth the reading. And it's not a happy ending, Pastor. I'm quite disappointed. Can you help me?
Yeah, you're not going to find a lot of happy endings within the time and space of the story in a lot of things in the Bible. It's most of it ends up and a tragic result. Verse 31 in Mark 10 explains where the happiness is, and that's, "Many who are first will be last, and the last will be first."
Trouble is, I'm not going to hear verse 31 in church this weekend when I hear the gospel.
Oh, right. Did they?
Because it ends at 22.
Well, then your preacher better put it in there. Because that's
well, here, let me make a note to my preacher here. Make sure that he knows that. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, that's the thing you've got to look at. Pastors have to do this, and it's a challenge because you don't always know where does the passage really start and end. But that one explains that you know, the people that don't have it well in this life, if they're Christians, you know, it's going to be a whole lot better in heaven. And those that are, and this is the issue with the rich young man, who is really poor, in one sense, he's poor spiritually. He is among those because he cannot give up his attachment to riches, that he will be among the last. Martin Luther talks about this in a couple of places, and I couldn't give you the quote, but Luther makes clear that the issue is not having riches or being poor. It's the question, are you attached to riches? And Luther says, he says that if you are always envying the rich and you're a poor man, you're just as bad as the rich man, because your attachment is to the riches, to the wealth of this earthly life. And that's the real issue. And that's what came out of here. It's not the fact that the rich young man was rich, is that he couldn't give up his attachment to the riches.
Now, in our previous hour here in our conversation with Pastor Michael Walder in Luke chapter 18, in that conversation we wound our way around to making the point that so many people, including Christians, are so caught up with the busyness of the day that applying some thought, applying some energy to thinking about eternity, what happens to us after we die, is not even, as I put it, not even on the radar screen for a lot of people. Here comes a rich young man who comes up to Jesus and asks, I think, a very good question. Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? He's thinking about those eternal things. This is a good question, isn't it, Pastor?
Yeah, it is.
So then why does Jesus seem to rebuke him? The answer, "Why do you call me good? No one is good except God alone," etc., etc., doesn't sound very warm to me.
Jesus is not warm and fuzzy. That's the
sure he is.
No, he is not. That's the impression we get from the paintings and maybe from some movies. But he is. He can be prickly, and when you see him with the children, boy, is he warm and fuzzy. But when you see him with adults, he is usually a prickly bear, and that's the message you get from the Gospels, and you can't really iron over it. And it's not that he doesn't love people. He's trying to disattach them from their attachments, the things of this world. You know, they've been given to us by God for the good of our neighbor and for our own sustenance, but not that we make an idol out of them and that becomes the whole purpose of life. And it's so easy for us to do that. And so Jesus is constantly dealing with this. I can say as a pastor, I constantly deal with it too. I mean, certainly with my own self. I always have fingers that are pointing back to me when I point to somebody else. But with our members as pastors, we see people that are really caught up in things, and it's not for their good, and we try to encourage them to go one way, and they just get caught up in it, and could be disaster, could be a lot of things. So Jesus is prickly because he's trying to bring people around to where they should be. And this is one of the men that needs his help that way.
So Jesus says, why do you call me good? What do you think? Let's just take that question right there before we move on to his other words. Why do you call me good? Why do you think that this man called Jesus good? Provoking that question or prompting that question from Jesus?
He is probably buttering him up.
You mean he has another agenda?
Oh, well, probably so, yeah. He's probably looking for some... he probably wants to be a follower of Jesus. I mean, because Jesus doesn't go around telling everybody to give up their goods. And it appears in the fact that Jesus tells him this. He says, go sell everything you have and give to the poor. Well, then come follow me. That's the key in verse 22. See, Jesus didn't say follow me to everybody. He said that to the people that became his apostles or the disciples. The word disciple means a follower who followed him from town to town. So he's not saying you have to do this to be a believer, but if you're going to be a disciple of Jesus, one of his apostles, you better do this. And he's not willing to do that. So he kind of wants to have his cake and eat it too. And Franklin Graham might be an example of this. I wouldn't say that because he's born into it. But there may be pastors out there that want to have, the latest sports car and two extra houses and live like the richest people in town. And also be the pastor at the same time. And Jesus says, leave those things behind and come follow me. You know, that's not what the ministry is all about. St. Paul makes that very clear, that some people think that ministry in the church is about profit. And he says it's not. Yes, it profits us spiritually, but not materially.
All right, let's take a telephone call here, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Hi, David, you're on the Bible study.
Hello, sir.
Good morning.
I just want to make a comment.
Sure.
Two sayings I've heard in my life, follow the money and fleecing the flock. And it seems to be more of an American phenomena. People use religion to make big amounts of money. And even though I can't judge their heart, it shows me that a lot of these so-called famous preachers, they're making big salaries, a lot of money, while the average American, you know, pays high taxes too, and a lot of people are unemployed, and they're living a life of, like you say, probably two, three houses, who knows. But I think that's what Jesus and the apostles frown on. They didn't live wealthy. You know, Christ didn't have a place to lay his head, and the apostles didn't live wealthy like that. And if I'm mistaken, maybe you can correct me.
All right, we'll talk about it. Thanks for the call. Doctor?
Well, first off, I have to support the average pastor who probably, as you said before, Chuck, doesn't get a reasonable salary for the work that he does. My rule of thumb, I don't know what our church body recommends. I mean, each district has its own thing. I think that pastors should make about what a public school teacher makes in a particular region, because he's gone through school at least as much as a public school teacher has. And, people don't want to pay too many taxes, so they're going to make sure that public school teachers don't make too much. So I think that's a good rule of thumb. And it should be enough that he can provide for his family and not be embarrassed. And that sometimes happens. Sometimes congregations are just, it's not necessarily the officers, but the people in the congregation are just want to get along, and they don't want to give anything. They're too cheap. So that's the first message. But then on the other side, I agree with David that there are people out there that see godliness as a means of profit, and it's demagoguery is what it is. It's you're in it for the money, and unfortunately there are many like that. This, by the way, is not a new criticism. At the time of St. Francis and John Wycliffe, before Martin Luther, there were complaints about the especially the upper clergy and the cardinals and the popes and all those people, because they were living high on the hog, as rich or richer than any prince in medieval Europe. And that's part of what attracted people to St. Francis, is that he said, that's wrong, we should live like Jesus, and not even wear shoes. That's why they were called the barefoot monks. Well, that's going too far. Here in St. Louis in Indiana, if I walk around barefoot, I won't have feet because of the freeze at wintertime. But besides that, I think David is correct, and that religious organizations, board of directors, need to keep track of this and avoid causing offense, and keep things in line with the example of Christ and the Protestant churches originally, as they were constituted back in Europe, and the critics of excessive pay in the history of the Christian church.
Here's another caller at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. James, you're on the Bible study.
Good morning, Pastor Nolan.
Morning.
It's good to hear you again. Your congregation is lucky to have you.
Thank you.
There was a talk about Oliver Cromwell as a reformer. So I'd like to know, what are your thoughts on that, and what would be the parallel to the Roundheads and the Cavaliers in today's church or political life?
Well, I hope you know the answer to that. Thank you, James. He sounds like he is pulling on your historical background there, Doctor.
Yeah, James, you got a good question there. I'll do the best I can. Oliver Cromwell was, by the way, the political leader. He wasn't a religious figure or preacher per se, but he was the political leader of the Puritans, I'm getting it mixed up, of the Cavaliers, they were attached to the Puritans during the English Civil War. And it was a fight on the one side between the Puritans and the Parliament, and on the other side with the Anglicans and the King. And so for a period of about 30 years after Parliament and the Puritans won, England was under what was called the Commonwealth, and it was run by Puritans. Cromwell was the head of state, and the Puritan was the theology. And after he died, it all fell apart and went back to the king and to the Anglicans. I don't know if there's a good example of that. I don't think our political parties today would really fit into that, except you could argue that, as Cromwell and the Puritans did, that they represented the common man and that the king and the Anglicans represented the upper class. And I think maybe you could say that the parties in the United States in the 20th century, the two main ones, have kind of split that way a little bit, although there are other issues. And when you talk about American politics, it's very complex because both parties, the main parties, want to draw in as many people as they can, so they won't just attract people of one economic class, but they'll try to get other people for other reasons. So there's no direct comparison. But it is important for the history of the United States, because the development of parliamentary law and the freedom of religion and the dominance of Protestantism all came from that period in the English Commonwealth under Oliver Cromwell.
All right, back to Mark chapter 10 here. We got a couple of minutes remaining. It says here that after Jesus says, you know the commandments, and then he enumerates them, the guy responds by saying, teacher, all these I have kept since I was a boy. Well, that's good news, because God gave his commandments to be kept, did he not? Verse 21 says, Jesus looked at him and loved him. Did Jesus love him, Pastor, because he had been faithful to keep the commandments since he was a boy, or did he love him for another reason?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure I can give a definite answer on what that word love here means. Jesus, of course, loves all of God's created children on the face of this earth. That's why he came to save us from our sins. But there it says loved him, and so it gives us a sense that Jesus had a particular appreciation for this character, this rich young man. We don't know his name. And I think what it was that this guy was really trying to do, I mean, beside the fact that he may have called him good teacher, Jesus kind of brushes that off, he was really trying to please God, which is a good thing. I mean, will you tell your child, oh, you're doing a bad thing because you're trying to please me? Well, no. I mean, that is a good thing. And so I think that this character, the rich young man, is he's basically got it right. He wants to please God, but he doesn't realize the extent of what's involved. And that really then gets down to the matter of the gospel, because there's no way we can please God ultimately with our obedience to the commandments, because we just can't do everything right. And we are all attached to various things in our life, and that's sin. And so we need the perfection of Christ and his sacrifice on the cross to make us acceptable and pleasing to God. And that's something that this poor guy doesn't quite get. He's a poor guy, but he's a rich young man.
Okay, so if my pastor preaches on Mark chapter 10, I got to remind him what to go to verse 31. Is that what you said?
He needs to read through 23 to 31.
Okay.
Because that's the Jesus explanation of what's going on with this young guy.
Now, if he stops short of that, should I put up my hand and stand up and encourage him to do that, or would that be kind of tacky?
Oh, why did you do that, Chuck?
I'll let you know how that goes.
Let me know how it goes. Okay?
Thank you, Doctor. Good to talk to you.
Okay.
Dr. Martin Nolan, Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. We continue in Luke 18 on Monday. Hope you can join us then.
Listen to Chuck Ratherton and guests Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the Internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of the Bible Study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible Study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.